Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking to Dr. Matthew Hirsch about his book titled Dark Star, A New History of the Space Shuttle, published by MIT Press in 2023. The book, I mean, in some ways does exactly what it says. It is a new history of the space shuttle, but it's more interesting than that, because it takes what we think we know about NASA's space shuttle and goes, hang on a second, we need to rethink this. So that's my favorite kind of history anyway. It's especially fascinating when used for such a topic that kind of exists in the popular imagination. So Matthew, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and this project? Why did you write this book?
Thank you. I'm Associate Professor of the History of Science at Harvard University. I'm an historian of technology, as well as of labor and popular culture, looking particularly at the Cold War era. And this book is a culmination not only of years of research, but in some respects, my whole life. I was born the same year that the space shuttle was authorized. It was the program of my childhood. But the book itself came out of research that I was doing for my first book project, Inventing the American Astronaut, on the history of NASA's astronaut corps. And when I began looking into the space shuttle, I found a very large and rich story. It actually was such a large story and such a rich story that I had trouble at first figuring out what the book was about. And the moment where I arrived at that conclusion actually derived from an experience I had in class. And it's always wonderful when one's experience teaching motivates and energizes the research that you do.
It does tend to end up with good books. So having read this one, I'm not surprised that that's where this one was prompted.
Thank you.
What then is kind of the book about? What's the question that you're asking, and how did you develop it?
I was teaching a course on engineering ethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and one of my very talented engineering students was patiently listening to a lecture I was giving about the destruction of the space shuttle Challenger. I talked about the canonical literature of technological failure, books that describe how large technological systems are prone to certain discrete kinds of failure modes, how this seemed to have taken place in the course of the destruction of the shuttle Challenger in 1986. And a student raised his hand and asked me if building large machines was simply pointless, whether the activities that the engineering students were learning how to do shouldn't be done at all, because the more complex the system becomes, the more likely it is to fail, and hence all they were really doing was building death traps. And it seemed to be the kind of lesson that a lot of the literature on the space shuttle was telling me, and it was a profoundly unsatisfying one as an instructor, because the last thing I wanted to do was to tell my engineers that their lives were pointless, that there was no use trying to build things well, or that they didn't have any responsibility to do so. And when I took another look at the materials that I had been teaching, I realized that I just didn't agree with them, that there was nothing about the space shuttle in particular that made its failure inexorable due only to the fact of its complexity. In fact, the space shuttle did not fail in the way that we understand it because it was simply complex. It didn't fail because all large machines are prone to that kind of destruction. And it didn't fail due to the peculiarities of the organizational culture of NASA, which is one of the major subjects of analysis when it comes to after-the-fact analyses of the destruction of the space shuttle. When I looked into the actual history of the construction of this discrete particular space vehicle, I realized that what lay behind all of its failures were bad choices made by individuals, people who knew better, but for various reasons found themselves forced or compelled or just didn't necessarily have the ability to build the vehicle they wanted and accepted something less. And actually, as a case study for student engineers, I found the space shuttle even more remarkable than I thought, because it really demonstrated that if you want to build safely and you want to build well, you have to do it from the very start.
All right. That, I think, gives a lot of good context for a sentence that particularly struck me in the book that I'm going to ask you to kind of take apart in more detail. Going back to that idea that it's about decisions and it's also kind of from the start, you have the sentence in the book, quote, "The shuttle was simply built the wrong way, at the wrong time, and for the wrong reasons." Now, obviously, that gives us a lot of things to pick apart, but
yes,
starting with the last one, for the wrong reasons, why was the idea of a space shuttle just impractical pretty much from the start, and yet why did it keep having a life?
This is something that struck me when I was reading through the history of this particular kind of vehicle. The space shuttle is unusual, and it wasn't like any of the American space vehicles that preceded it, in that it was a winged space plane that was designed to be reusable. And it had the mode of travel of an airplane. The idea was that it would be launched into space atop a rocket and supplemented by its own rocket engines. It would fly into space, it would orbit the Earth, and it would return through the atmosphere and land like an airplane. It's a very peculiar mode of operating a spaceship when you think about it. We may be familiar with programs like Project Apollo or Gemini or Mercury that launched capsules into space and then recovered them at sea, which is conceptually much simpler to do and in many cases much safer. And so why was the space shuttle built in this particular way? What did it represent? And what I found is an actually century-long history of efforts by engineers to try to build a spaceship that looked like an airplane. And at each particular iteration of this concept, the idea failed. It proved technologically unworkable. And yet it kept being brought back to life by engineers, by politicians, by military figures who saw in this kind of amorphous and to some extent purposeless vehicle the answer to certain political or social or economic problems that were presented for themselves. During World War II, the space plane seemed like a solution to the problem of Allied air superiority. This gigantic rocket plane called the Silbervogel or Silverbird would fly higher than Allied interceptors, would travel across an ocean and bomb New York City or Washington, D.C. With complete impunity. Later, during the 1950s, the Air Force saw a piloted winged space vehicle as the solution to the problem of nuclear war, an accurate delivery vehicle that would still require the services of the thousands of pilots that still constituted the bulk of the leadership of the United States Air Force. And then later in the 1960s and 1970s, the space shuttle emerged as a plausible big program that would allow NASA to maintain its budgets at 1960s levels while solving a variety of political problems, particularly for the Nixon administration. President Richard Nixon, of course, also thought that the space shuttle would be the solution to his reelection in 1972, if it were built in a particular place where voters who worked in the aerospace industry were a considerable source of support. Throughout history, we find examples of this not terribly good idea being brought back to life to serve immediate political or economic ends, ending ultimately in the 1980s when the space shuttle was actually trumpeted as an instrument of free enterprise that would commercialize NASA's operations and usher in a new age of space capitalism.
Yeah, I admit my eyebrows raised pretty hard when I got to that part of the book. that was particularly strange. But let's not jump ahead too far chronologically.
Yes.
in that kind of mix of reasons and actors in favor of the space shuttle, you went kind of all the way back to World War II, you know, pre-NASA, which I admit, I sort of assume all space things, NASA, they kind of go together in my head. But given that start before then, how did the establishment of NASA impact all of these ideas running around for a space shuttle and proposals of what it could look like?
That's a really fascinating question, and the organizational politics associated with this story are terribly interesting to me, in part because NASA, when it is formed in 1958, is actually an amalgam of a variety of government laboratories, some of which are very wedded to the concept of winged flight, and others are research institutions devoted to rocketry. And, for example, a difference of opinion between a facility at Langley, Virginia, formerly operated by the NACA, and an Army facility in Huntsville, Alabama, that was the place of work of Wernher von Braun and several expatriate German engineers, as well as Americans and others. And each of these had different ideas about spaceflight and how it should be conducted. NASA found itself, during its early years, forced to choose a path into space that would be conceptually simplest, easiest, and fastest, because it was in a race with the Soviet Union. And everyone knew that if you wanted to try to build a reusable piloted space plane, which was just about the hardest kind of space vehicle anybody could imagine assembling, that was going to take a very long time. And if the United States wished to beat the Soviet Union into orbit or to the moon, you wouldn't need a winged vehicle to do it. There's no air in space. There's no air on the moon. Wings don't generate lift in space. It's a completely useless appendage for any kind of space vehicle. But at the same time, the community of winged flight and winged test flight in NASA still lobbied extensively for this kind of technology. And also, with the conclusion of Project Apollo, made a rather specious argument that the future of space travel necessitated a winged reusable vehicle, that the era of the capsule was over, and that the only way that NASA would be able to maintain its viability as a spacefaring organization was through the pursuit of this technology.
All right. Let's talk more about that, because the whole idea of wings are useless in space thing, I think, needs to be investigated a bit more. Can you tell us about these, quote, required specifications for the proposed space shuttle? We've talked about wings. You mentioned reusable, piloted. How did these evolve over the decades? And why were some things kind of quite consistent across proposals versus ideas that came and went?
The only thing that was truly consistent within all of the proposals for a space shuttle from the period of roughly the mid to late 1960s through 1972, when it was authorized, and a couple of years later when the design was finalized, was that it had to be a winged vehicle. There was almost a kind of predestination there, or at least a determination by forces within NASA and contractors that this would be a winged vehicle, because the idea that NASA was selling at this point was that the key to successful space exploration in the future would be to lower the cost of bringing cargo and people into space. Now, you could do this in all kinds of ways. You could use a reusable capsule launch vehicle and a reusable rocket, and that certainly works. You could use a very cheap disposable or expendable launch vehicle, and that's another approach that NASA pursued. But people who had always been enthusiastic about space planes argued that if you really wanted to get into space cheaply, you should copy the model of passenger aviation, in which you have a vehicle that is reused hundreds of times, that is built to survive many trips into the air and back, and that lands at relatively rudimentary facilities like runways, and that the incredible cost economy associated with air travel would be reproduced in space if we built our rocket ships more like jetliners. Prior to that, there were other arguments why space planes were superior, but in the budget crunch of the late 1960s and early 1970s, the key argument for NASA was a connection between a variety of unrelated concepts, the concept of cost effectiveness, the concept of reusability, and the concept of winged flight. And NASA argued that the best vehicle would embrace all of these qualities. It turns out building such a vehicle is virtually impossible, and it's actually very expensive to operate if you do. But that was at least the rationale that undergirded it. And the problem that NASA encountered, mostly between the period of around 1968 and 1972, was that every iteration of this kind of space vehicle that it asked contractors to develop had some kind of major deficiency in its cost effectiveness, in the expense of operation, and its safety. And especially once the Nixon administration determined that the budget would be roughly half of what would be required to create a truly safe vehicle. Every space shuttle was a compromise, and a dangerous one at that.
So then, how in the world does it actually get built?
After the successful Apollo moon landing programs, an effort within NASA to do something really big, interplanetary explorations, space stations, and a space shuttle that would ferry astronauts to and from the various other vehicles that would operate in space. The Nixon administration says it's never going to happen. You're not going to get the funding for that. You can build one thing effectively. And not only that, but the Nixon administration says you can only build it if there's Air Force participation. The Air Force at this particular time maintained its own space program that launched military satellites. In addition, the American intelligence regime had basically its own parallel program as well. Some people have said that the United States at any one time has always had basically two or three different space programs, each roughly equally funded, to launch military and national security payloads in addition to civilian ones. And the Air Force is very skeptical of the space shuttle. It had done some research on the concept and figured that it was actually a bad investment. But here, in the early 1970s, the Nixon administration was saying the Air Force is going to get a free vehicle paid for by NASA, and demands that NASA allow the Air Force to determine the specifications of the shuttle, the size, the shape, and the mode of operation. And this is almost too good to be true for the Air Force. They recognize that they need a space vehicle that can carry large spy satellites into orbit. These have a particular size and dimension, and they demand that NASA reorient the space shuttle to carry these kinds of extremely large payloads and to be able to fly in particular modes that suit Air Force needs. NASA doesn't really have a choice. It gives them a space vehicle they don't really want and it will be harder to build, but it's a condition that the Nixon administration places on this vehicle. So we start from pure ideas of reusable winged civilian scientific space vehicles, and instead we get a shadow military program that doesn't do what the scientists and the engineers really wanted to, that's designed to serve the interests of a military service branch that doesn't even want it.
Okay. This is not boding particularly well, so let's make it worse. You mentioned at the beginning I mentioned the quote at the beginning that it was built in the wrong way and at the wrong time and for the wrong reason. We talked about reasons. Can you tell us more about the built in the wrong ways part? And especially if this was known, I mean, you mentioned kind of multiple contractors having plans with deficiencies. Why didn't they fix the problems?
They didn't fix the problems because they couldn't. And one thing that surprised me when I started reading the literature is that at the time, the final version of the space shuttle, the thrust augmented orbiter shuttle, was created, the engineers and think tank analysts who basically came up with the concept knew that this was actually not what NASA wanted or needed, but it was a vehicle that would give the appearance of a functioning shuttle long enough for it to be replaced when money became available. The pure concept of a space shuttle that NASA wanted to impose, which was the brainchild of a legendary designer named Max Faget, as well as a variety of other people, was two vehicles, each of them reusable, each made out of sturdy metal alloys. They would fly into space piggybacked, with the orbiting vehicle basically lifting off from the carrier vehicle in flight, traveling into orbit and returning, with both of those vehicles piloted, unable to land on runways. And this would be a wonderfully robust transportation system that would cost $12 billion. The Nixon administration says, well, you can have six. Do what you can with that. And if you're going to cut the budget by that much, you're going to sacrifice something. You will probably have to sacrifice reusability, because making reusable components is very, very expensive to do. You also might have to compromise safety in terms of redundancies and in terms of the materials that you might use to fabricate this vehicle. There were additional requirements in that the Air Force wouldn't let NASA and its contractors use heat-resistant titanium for the construction of the fuselage because it was necessary for other military programs. So you're left with an aluminum-framed airplane, not unlike a jetliner, that has to be coated and protected in special ways to survive the extreme heat and other stresses that are placed upon space vehicles in flight. The idea of having two reusable vehicles falls out the window. Instead, the best that NASA can do is a reusable orbiter with a variety of reusable and disposable boosters and tanks attached to it, so it can just barely get itself into orbit with the required weight established by the Air Force, but with the understanding that this is a vehicle that will require a tremendous amount of refurbishment between flights, as well as a great deal of maintenance and overhaul. And in a way, the shuttle that's actually created is a marvel of engineering. It's about 2 million individual moving parts. It's a very complex machine. It does things no other American space vehicle can do, but it's a kludge, as the engineers would have said at the time. It's a quick fix that's designed to mimic the performance of a better vehicle and convince people that it's actually real, just long enough to demonstrate the feasibility of the concept, at which point it could be replaced with something that actually works. And it's the last part that never happens.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Yeah, no, and we're going to get into that because first I want to get to the, to what extent does it even do the job of convincing people it works long enough to talk about a replacement. The space shuttle, of course, has some pretty famous losses. For example, the Challenger in 1986. How did this transform the space shuttle, both kind of practically, but also this conceptual marketing campaign or attempt that's being made on the thinking side?
There wasn't a single failure associated with the space shuttle, either the one that failed Challenger in 1986 or Columbia in 2003, that engineers didn't know about in advance. The failure modes of the space shuttle were well known, and they were basically features inherent to the design choices made by the people who created the space shuttle. But the degree of danger associated with the space shuttle wasn't that much different from other space vehicles that had been flown by the United States. And the engineers often had an attitude, well, this is a dangerous business. We're going to have some losses. When it came to the particular failure, the O-ring failure in one of the solid rocket boosters of Space Shuttle Challenger, this was a failure that had occurred almost on every launch in some kind of way. It was a known problem. And it was not that engineers thought that it would always be okay and it would always be fine. They actually knew that actually the shuttle would be lost. In fact, the engineers had predicted that probably maybe two or three shuttles might be lost over the course of the program, which is very close to the actual historical numbers. And destruction of the shuttle completely eviscerated the cost model that had been associated with the shuttle, but also the very idea of its utility as a reusable safe vehicle that could lower the cost of carrying people and humans into space, that might democratize space travel by allowing more people, including average citizens, to fly into space, and that it might usher in a new golden age of spaceflight that would be characterized by routine operations in Earth orbit. It also marked the virtual suspension of military efforts to attempt to use the space shuttle as a vehicle to fly its important payloads. There were some experiments that were flown afterwards, but the United States Air Force, which had never been supportive of the space shuttle, immediately decided that it would pursue a new generation of expendable launch vehicles. And what was probably the ultimate blow, the idea that the space shuttle would serve as a tool of business was rendered completely moot by the banning of all commercial payloads from the space shuttle. Leaving the United States with an extremely expensive transportation infrastructure that could no longer do any of the jobs that were assigned to it.
Did the space shuttle program do anything well?
And that's actually a very good question. And the answer is yes, but almost none of the things it was supposed to do well. What the space shuttle excelled at is providing a way for as many as 8 people to travel into space for up to 2 weeks at a time, which was a huge crew size and had never happened before. The United States was able to fly hundreds of people into space over the course of basically 134 successful missions into orbit. The vehicle also proved to have such a large cargo bay that a large number of satellites and other forms of instrumentation could be launched into space aboard it. And probably the most well-known example of that is the Hubble Space Telescope, which was not only launched into space using the space shuttle, but due to the space shuttle's unique capacity to rendezvous and dock with other space vehicles, it could be repaired in orbit by astronauts who were aboard the shuttle. So it was a vehicle with some really robust capabilities. In fact, so robust a group of capabilities that for a while the Soviet Union was desperate to produce one for itself. But these pale in comparison to the really elaborate dreams and really fantasies associated with this particular vehicle and what it would do.
Okay, so there are some things, I suppose, but as you said, they don't quite match up with what the plan was. So let's then get to kind of the goal of it, of getting to something better. Why wasn't the space shuttle replaced with something else? Were there alternatives?
There were always alternatives. Even at the time that the shuttle was built, there were some really compelling options for different kinds of technologies. The problems with the space shuttle, particularly its expensive operation and the fact that it would never be as economical to run as people thought, led NASA, almost from the very beginning of space shuttle flights in the early 1980s, to try to imagine some kind of modification of the vehicle that would make it more cost effective or make it more useful. And among these was removing the astronauts entirely from the vehicle and turning the shuttle into an unpiloted cargo carrier, which was problematic because that undermined was the essential logic that had guided the approval of the space shuttle to begin with, which is a single vehicle that the United States could operate that would do everything that the Americans needed to do in space, from launching astronauts to launching satellites. So that was an option that wasn't pursued. In fact, when it came time to imagining future iterations, NASA decided effectively to double down on a really problematic technology and try something even harder. One of the problems associated with the space shuttle was its reliance on external booster rockets and fuel tanks. A dream of space engineers really for about a century was to create a space vehicle that was so efficient in its use of fuel and so light in its design that a single entire vehicle could orbit itself intact, fly in space, and return. And if that vehicle was in the shape of an airplane or some kind of lift-generating body, it could land on runways, which would make it even more effective and cheap to operate than the space shuttle that NASA built. And this kind of vehicle was called a single-stage-to-orbit vehicle. It is the white whale of space engineering because to this day, no one's ever actually built one, although we've gotten very close. And efforts by NASA to build vehicles in this particular mode always came up short, leading it ultimately to abandon the space plane concept entirely.
All right, then. That explains why the plan didn't work in that sense either. You mentioned right at the beginning kind of being surprised by the question from your student and that prompting this, and mentioned a few surprises along the way. And I found many things about this surprising. But I was wondering, in your investigation to put all of this together, is there anything in particular that you remember kind of coming across or realizing and going, hang on, that is not what I thought I was going to find?
That happened. And as a researcher, it happened several times, and that's always happy news because there's nothing better than going to the archives and finding a smoking gun, as they call it, that one document that says something that nobody probably should have said that tells you that your underlying thesis is correct. But it also makes you sad because people died. This was a tragedy, a multiple set of tragedies, which I think was avoidable, had a system for creating ideas and advancing them at the political level worked appropriately. And among the things I encountered were memos, particularly one by an outgoing NASA administrator to his successor, saying, basically, I'm washing my hands of this problem, but I felt that my conscience demanded that you know that there's something wrong here with the space shuttle. I will say nothing more about it. I have no more control over it, but I basically could not leave office without telling you there's something wrong here and this is a problem. And when you see something like that, it makes you stop and it's just chilling. And other memoranda that I encountered indicated that rank-and-file engineers within NASA became increasingly frustrated by a program that was becoming so overwhelmed by a desire to meet particular political targets in terms of performance that the accounting for how much it would cost became wildly fanciful, and so much so that NASA itself found itself unable to properly keep track of how much programs were costing because the numbers had been finessed, and that engineers were kind of flat out in saying this, and that it seemed particularly sad because it concerned elements and aspects of the space shuttle that no one thought were valuable or useful. And I wanted to see, perhaps as a space enthusiast myself, a story of people who really believed that the work that they were doing was useful and valuable and had a great deal of confidence in what they were doing. But instead, from astronauts, from engineers, from administrators, from politicians, from external watchers of the program, I saw a series of warnings that said the same thing over and over again. Don't do this.
Agree about the fun to find things in an archive. Agree. I come from war studies that often those finds are actually quite depressing.
Yes.
But also fascinating to kind of put them together and see the story that they tell, especially given that so much of that story that you just described is about saying, don't do this, right? Mm-hmm. Please learn from the information I'm giving you. Please don't do this. What lessons can we as readers take from this history that you've put together?
Well, a part of the book is, I wouldn't quite say a challenge, but it is an effort to qualify our existing understanding of how we assess technological risk and the dangers of technological systems. I make much use in the book of Diane Vaughan's Challenger launch decision, which is a monumental postmortem analysis of the loss of the Challenger that argues, coming from the field of sociology, that the organizational dysfunction of NASA made engineers believe that a system that was inherently unsafe actually was. When I looked into Diane Vaughan's book and into other materials, I found that there really wasn't very compelling astronaut evidence that the engineers themselves were convinced that the shuttle was safe. Rather, there was something worse, a kind of fatalism, an expectation that, as one engineer put it at the time, that the chances of my tires blowing out when I'm driving on the highway are about the same as an O-ring failure on a space shuttle. And the astronauts would have to learn to accept the risk of death in the same way that I accept the risk of death every time I drive. That's not confidence. That's a kind of nihilism that's born by an understanding of the difficulties associated with space engineering. And that the problem is even worse because at the time the space shuttle was authorized, engineers knew that this wasn't the best way to build a vehicle. And they said so. But they were told repeatedly that we don't have the money to do anything better. It'll never fly long enough that this will be a problem. Space flight is dangerous and people will die, and that's just the business we're in. And as someone who teaches engineering students, I always tell them, that's not the point at which you stop. That's the point in which you say, hey, is there a better technological solution to this problem? And if there isn't, maybe we should rethink what we're doing here. Because history is replete with examples of people who saw poorly made technologies and organized an effort through technological innovation, through regulation, through pressure on business to replace bad technologies with good technologies, to replace the penny farthing with the safety bicycle, to replace the white phosphorus match with the red phosphorus match, to eliminate mercury batteries, to control dangerous technologies. And the lesson I try to teach my students most is that we are not forced by the inexorable march of progress to accept technologies that we don't want. The story of the history of technology is a story of technological choice, of decisions we made about what we will build, how we will build it, and we have only ourselves to blame if we do that wrong.
That, I imagine, is a pretty effective message to your engineering students, and one that I very much hope is going to be part of your answer to my final question. Because my next question is kind of, what are you doing now that this book is done? And I'm hoping that part of the answer is continuing to teach students.
Yes, I think that'll always be part of what I do. It's been very generative for my work. And also, I feel very fortunate to have the opportunity to do that. I'm writing books in part because I'm fascinated by the subject, but I believe that there are lessons here, and I want to help people do and be better. And I think that professors have a very powerful role in society, and that if people don't get these lessons from us, I'm not sure where they're going to get them. I'm interested in continuing my work in space exploration, as well as looking at the history of technology more broadly. Most recently, I've been looking at transformations of the work of being a spacefarer in more recent years, particularly the rise of robotics and space tourism. The job of being an astronaut is not quite as glamorous or glorious as it once was. People are who do it are no longer household names. And the number of people who do it have actually have declined by percentage faster than coal miners. This is possibly a job that is going to be replaced almost entirely by machines in the near future, which is something that people have always imagined would happen. And it's part of a larger story that I like to tell of the changing face of labor. In a world that is characterized by the arrival of new and disruptive technologies. My work on the space shuttle and the space program came out of not only an interest in space, but in my interest as a labor historian, as someone who's had a couple of professions myself and is very interested in how humans create cultures around highly technical modes of work.
All right. Well, if that becomes a book, we have to have you back because I need to learn more now. Thank you very much for that preview. Best of luck completing that project. Hopefully it's a book and we can have you back. But in the meantime, listeners can read the book we've been discussing titled Dark Star, A New History of the Space Shuttle, published by MIT Press. Matthew, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much. I've had a wonderful time.